On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Long-Term Contaminant Management Using Institutional Controls. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Moscow, Idaho. I'm going to be the moderator on today's call. I'm going to quickly cover some introductory materials and then turn the presentation over to our ITRC team. As listed on the slide, today's training is based on the online guidance document, Long-Term Contaminant Management Using Institutional Controls. We're going to introduce you to the document during today's training, and we do hope that it becomes a resource that you can use after today's class. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, or CLUIN. A few housekeeping items to cover as we're getting started today. Today's course is 2.25 hours. We are recording this session, and we do offer archives after our training courses. The trainers control the slides today. If you want to control your own slides, you can go back to that CLUIN training page where you started today and download the PowerPoint presentation. Throughout today's training, you're welcome to send in questions using that Q&A box in the lower right. In some cases, we'll get right back to you with an answer. In other cases, we're going to send that question, or we're going to answer that question in our question and answer break. At the end of the class, we do ask for everyone to fill out the feedback form. We really do use your feedback. It's also your opportunity to get a certificate for attending today's class. If you'd like to have a larger version of just the slides, you look up top of the slides, there's an icon with arrows going out in the four corners, and that's going to allow you to have a full screen of just the slides. To exit the full screen, you slide your mouse back up to the top, the gray bar appears again, and a similar icon will allow you to exit, but the arrows are going back in, so that allows you to exit the full screen. We also have closed captioning along the bottom today, and that's something that you can turn on and off. So if you would like, you can look for the drop-down that allows you to turn off the closed captioning. More information about ITRC is available on the website. ITRC is a network that's led by state regulators. It includes our federal partners, Department of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency, as well as members from industry, academia, and community stakeholders. The full version of the ITRC disclaimer is included in the notes section of this slide and on the ITRC website. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor U.S. government warranty material or endorse specific products. We recommend you check with local, state, and federal laws and experts. We do encourage you to use ITRC's presentations and documents for educational purposes, both in your work and if you need to deliver training to others. We ask that you please credit ITRC, review the ITRC usage policy, and let us know about your successes. Use of ITRC materials for profit is not permitted. More information is available on the ITRC website. We have a wide variety of technical and regulatory guidance documents. We also have our schedule laid out for all of 2018, so you can look at our online and classroom training schedule. I'll introduce our trainers for today's class. All trainers were members of the ITRC Long-Term Contaminant Management Using Institutional Controls team. More information about the trainers is available in their bios, and if you follow the link at the bottom of the slide, you can scroll down and see the list of trainers. If you select their name, you'll see a photo and a brief bio. Our first trainer today is Kevin Schrems from the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. We also have on the line Doug Birch with Ramboll, Mike Sawinski of Teradex, and Lynn Bailey of the Hawaii Department of Health. I'll now turn the presentation over to Kevin Schrems at the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. Kevin?
Thank you, Juliana. And thank you to all the attendees who are participating today. We are very excited for the opportunity to introduce to you our guidance document that is now available. Now, before the other presenters dive into the specifics of our materials, I want to take some time for setting the stage for institutional controls and lay the groundwork how our guidance was developed. For many of you on the call, the concept of leaving contamination in place was previously not an acceptable way of achieving closure under most regulatory programs. Most programs required contamination to be cleaned up to background or native concentrations. Since the mid-1990s, risk-based corrective action, or RBCA, and the use of institutional controls has become an important part of many federal, state, and local cleanup and brownfield programs. ICs are generally administrative or legal controls that help to minimize the potential for exposure now and into the future to contamination and also protect the integrity of the remedy. ICs have helped fuel redevelopment and reduce the cost and time to achieve closure at many sites. As an aside, the state that I work in Michigan, has the tagline of R for R, or remediation for redevelopment, emphasizing considering sites for remediation work based on the potential for redevelopment of the site and the environmental and public health risks. For more background discussion of ICs, you can read ITRC's 2008 document, which is noted and I believe hyperlinked at the bottom of the screen. The terminology and process descriptions used in ITRC's guidance are consistent with those used in the Superfund program. In addition to the bullets on the screen, the picture on the right half of the screen also visually illustrates the differences between engineering controls and institutional controls. Examples of engineering controls include vapor barriers, physical or hydraulic containment, asphalt or concrete, and vapor mitigation systems. Now, institutional controls are those more social or paper types of documents. They protect the integrity of the engineering control or minimize the potential for human exposure to contamination. For example, as noted in the screen, there is a restriction for groundwater use. Now, both engineering and institutional controls are incorporated under the umbrella of land use controls, which is used in ITRC's guidance document. Land use controls are used to provide protection from exposure to contaminants that exist or remain on the site. Upon initiating the process of developing this guidance, ITRC understood that agencies use ICs at contaminated sites as remedies. However, we did not know the full extent of their use. ITRC also did not understand various state agency IC selection and implementation processes or the regulatory framework governing institutional controls. Finally, ITRC really wanted to gather that information to determine how states manage and fund the ICs once they're in place, along with any data indicating that state agencies performed monitoring, tracking, enforcement, and stakeholder outreach. To better understand these questions, ITRC surveyed existing state programs to determine what makes these programs effective and what issues affect the durability of ICs. The survey was submitted to the ITRC representatives for all 50 states, and 44 responses were received. Overall, the survey responses have been used to identify which elements help maintain or create a more effective long-term IC program. As shown above, this guidance focuses on ICs already in place, rather than the details of selecting ICs. Properly selecting and implementing ICs, however, is essential for long-term durability and effectiveness. Therefore, this guidance provides a summary of some of the key components that are considered when choosing an IC. Now, during this presentation and also in our guidance document, you will see this diagram, which illustrates the five essential elements of the IC lifecycle. Beneath the elements of the lifecycle, we list critical components that must be considered to achieve a successful IC management program. These essential elements and components essentially form the structure of the guidance document, and the various sections in the guidance document address each of these elements. Together, these create an effective long-term stewardship program. As the presenters transition between each element, you will see this figure reappear on the screen highlighting the next topic. Now, this guidance is relevant to environmental regulators at all levels of government, private and public, responsible or obligated parties, current site owners and operators, environmental consultants, prospective purchasers of property, and real estate agents. Additionally, stakeholders who have an interest in property will find this guidance helpful in understanding the elements required to manage ICs. This guidance assists those who are responsible for stewardship of ICs by describing the critical elements and best practices for an IC management program. Much of this document is based on the successes and lessons learned from established state and federal agency programs. As part of the guidance, ITRC has also developed a downloadable tool that can help create a long-term stewardship plan tailored to specific sites. This tool incorporates the various IC management practices presented here to assist in the early stage of site-specific IC planning. So let's talk about failure of an institutional control. We do know and recognize that they fail. I'd like to provide an example of a failure that happened in my state. A prospective purchaser of property was conducting due diligence prior to purchasing the property. The property was in the location of a former leaking underground storage tank that was closed in 1997 with an institutional control in the form of a deed restriction, which included land use restrictions and a groundwater use restriction. During the due diligence efforts, the prospective purchaser found that the property had been actually split into two parcels, one parcel now being zoned as residential, with a home built and a new drinking water well installed in 2001. Now, these circumstances went undetected by the regulatory agency until 2015, when a prospective purchaser called the regulatory agency asking about the closure and the land use restrictions concerning the well. Subsequent investigatory work was conducted and fortunately determined that the new residence and drinking water well were side gradient of the contaminated groundwater plume, and that the violations of the land use restrictions did not result in a long-term exposure to groundwater contamination. The breach of the institutional controls had occurred a mere 4 years after the placement of the restrictions on groundwater use. This should be well within the institutional knowledge that can be reasonably expected of an agency staff. With land use and permitting agencies operating as separate programs from the regulatory agency, the lack of an outreach program and monitoring program led to the confusion and ultimately the permitting of the drinking water well, a zoning change split in parcels with different addresses and parcel IDs from the original parcel that contained the restrictions. Presumably an outreach program aimed at local health departments, which are the water well permitting agencies, the local health department would have likely known of the groundwater contamination in the area and would likely have been better informed of the groundwater use restrictions. In recent years, the regulatory agency has implemented an outreach program with local health departments to discuss the use of an online environmental mapper and database to ensure that they have all the information to fully evaluate drinking water well applications and to assist them in making good and protective permitting decisions. We just heard about one example of why ICs fail. What are some of the other examples? I'd like Juliana, if she could, to bring up the poll results from the beginning of our webinar to see what the other top vote getters were for why institutional controls fail. Like many of our other ITRC webinar presentations that we have provided in the past year and a half, the top three reasons for institutional controls to fail include monitoring is inadequate, communication is inadequate, and potentially that the institutional control was not implemented. I can also say that to further discuss my state of Michigan and where I work with the Remediation and Redevelopment Division, myself and another person have begun to do a pilot study for monitoring institutional controls that have been in place sort of as a drive-by survey to see if institutional controls are being complied with or if they're failing. So we're trying to see if, even though the monitoring is inadequate, whether we can quantify whether institutional controls have failed. And so we're working through the results, and we may even possibly publish that on our website for folks within our state as well as nationwide to see those results. Okay. Now, what makes IC failure a significant issue is that the potential for exposure grows as more ICs are used and not properly managed and monitored. To illustrate the universe of ICs used across the nation, this map indicates that 60% of states that have responded to our survey stated that they have over 200 institutional controls in place in their states. But what we've seen is that programs to manage institutional controls can vary widely, and some states do not have any formal IC management program. Now, that may be regardless of whether they have more than 200, less than 200. It varies across the country. Now, there are solutions to prevent failures of institutional controls, which is presented in ITRC's new guidance document and discussed in today's presentation. An IC can only remain effective so long as it continues to be recognized, respected, and upheld by the affected stakeholders. Not only does the awareness of a new IC need to be communicated with the affected community, but this awareness should be maintained throughout the life of the IC. Stakeholder outreach discussed later in the presentation includes identifying and involving internal and external stakeholders throughout the life of the IC. In addition to the guidance, ITRC went one step farther and developed a downloadable tool that takes users through the process of planning and designing an IC management needs. This tool can help create a long-lasting record of the site that includes the regulatory authority, details of the institutional control, the responsibilities of all parties, a schedule for monitoring the performance of the IC, and more. The tool generates an editable long-term stewardship plan in Microsoft Word. If you are a consultant or a regulatory entity who is closing sites with long-term monitoring, you will really want to stay tuned to near the end of today's session, where we will provide a brief tutorial walkthrough on the downloadable tool. Now, up next is Doug Burge, an industry representative from Ramboll, who will be briefly discussing planning and implementation, and then stakeholder outreach.
Thanks, Kevin. So as shown on our lifecycle diagram for long-term management of an institutional control, you'll see throughout our presentation, the first two elements of an institutional control is planning and implementation. Now, our guidance document assumes that planning and implementation has already been completed and the site's moved on to the next stage, which is long-term management, hence the name of our document. We as a team realize there's no need to reinvent the wheel. Guidance on planning and implementation already exists and is available through USEPA, ITRC, and many others. And I've even used that at several sites in different states and federal and state sites, and it's very helpful. However, where it sometimes tends to fall a little short is long-term management of the IC. It's great in describing the planning and implementation. However, moving beyond the planning and implementation stage, it sometimes doesn't provide a lot of information. But since planning and implementation are two early elements, I want to provide a brief summary of them since they are key components to an IC. So first off, we'll start with planning. Be sure that you understand your site. Be sure that you understand it thoroughly. The more you know about the site, the better you can plan your IC. Be sure you assess all your parameters of concern. You're aware of all the parameters that could be out there. What's their distribution? What media are affected? What are potential exposure pathways? What are complete exposure pathways? What are potential exposure pathways? what's the current and future land use? Is it residential development now? Is it going to be residential development? You just have to be aware of everything that can happen there. Also, plan for the full costs of an IC. An IC is not a get-out-of-jail-free card. In some cases, you may want to craft your IC or do some remediation on the site to make the IC a little more enforceable or manageable. Remember that they have both costs and responsibilities. Next step, once you've completed planning the phase of your IC, the next is to implement the ICs. That includes formalizing it, putting it in an environmental covenant, and then recording it with your essentially recorder of deeds quite often. Now, an IC is more than just a piece of paper sitting in that filing cabinet, the recorder's office. Once that's recorded, you've actually just started your journey in keeping that IC managed. Now, nearly half, 46% of respondents to our ITRC survey indicated that lack of proper implementation was a reason for an IC failure. Long-term stewardship is a critical element in successfully implementing ICs. And as part of our guidance document, we provided a tool for developing a long-term stewardship plan. And as Kevin mentioned, this is going to be discussed later in our presentation, but I strongly suggest you pay attention and stay tuned and look at, into potentially using that. I think it will help you with both the planning and implementation stages. So moving on to communication and outreach. Outreach begins with your planning and implementation, but it also extends through the entire life cycle of the IC. And the life of an IC can be decades, in many cases it could be forever. For effective outreach and communication, you need to identify your stakeholders, establish and maintain communication with those stakeholders, and inform stakeholders of their roles and/or responsibilities. You can think of these three things as ingredients. If you properly address them in combination, then it'll result in successful outreach. But if you skimp on an ingredient or forget an ingredient, the result's going to be you're probably going to have problems. Now, our ITRC survey determined that 41% of IC failures were a direct result of inadequate communication. So think about that. Almost half of failures resulted in outreach communication was not being effectively implemented. So remember, outreach success is equal to a successful IC. Well, outreach failure is equal to an institutional control failure. It's as simple as that. So who or what is an IC stakeholder? A stakeholder is not limited to just the owner of a specific property. Obviously, they're an important stakeholder in it, but there's many others, and includes all affected and or interested parties. This can include individuals and groups, such as nearby property owners, tenants, construction workers, environmental consultants. I mean, the list goes on and on. Use a broad brush when you define who is affected. Now, in our guidance document, we provide a general summary of typical stakeholders and their potential concerns, and it's in Table 5 of our guidance document if you want to look that up. I'm not going to read it all to you through this. So where do stakeholders fit in? Each stakeholder in an IC has their own set of concerns as well as their own set of responsibilities, and that is to ensure continued success of an IC. Common concerns include, how does this affect my health or the health of those people in my property? Is this going to affect the value of my property? That's a big one that comes along a lot. Suddenly you have a red check mark next to your property. Is it going to be worth less? Am I going to sell it? Am I going to use my property the way I want to? Is it going to be a blight on our community? I often get calls from landowners or people who ask, how can I develop the property now that I have an institutional control on it? Responsibilities can include keeping records and reporting to a registry, to a regulatory agency. I have a site in Minnesota. Once a year, they have to send a letter to the state of Minnesota saying that we've still got our IC in place and that it's being maintained properly. So if an IC says something such as don't install a well, That means you don't install a well, and that also means you make sure that no one else installs a well on that property. For an IC to be successful and remain effective, stakeholders' concerns should be addressed, and they must be aware of and understand their responsibilities. Remember, stakeholders are often a wide range of individuals and groups, and so are their concerns, so are their responsibilities, and so are their information needs. So there's many communication methods that can be used to provide information to stakeholders. Some of these communication methods may be mandated as part of implementing your IC, and some of them may be voluntary. And I suggest you use as many tools as you can in order to strengthen your IC over the long term. So the two primary methods of communication are often used in combination. These are direct and passive outreach. Direct outreach is also known as push. That means you're pushing information out to stakeholders. This can include something as simple as posting a no fishing or a don't eat the fish sign. It could be something much more sophisticated, like having ICs on an excavation clearance one-call system. That's not a tool that's available everywhere right now, but I think where it is available, I think it's an incredibly strong and good tool to use. The other form of outreach is passive outreach. That's also known as pull. That means you're making information available for stakeholders to find. This can be like putting an IC on a property deed and providing information on IC in a searchable database. I have an IC that I put on a site in Nebraska, and after that was put in, our client shortly thereafter sold the property, and it was split into several parcels. And we made sure that we informed all of the new property owners of their responsibilities with those parcels and what the ICs were. Well, lo and behold, a couple years later, I get a call from one of those property owners, and they're thinking about developing the property. And they're asking me, okay, what can I specifically do and not do, just the research? And I was very happy to get that call, not only because my institutional control was being effective, but that it shows that the push and pull communication was working. We pushed that information to the new landowner, and then they reached out later on and pulled more information to make sure they were properly implementing the IC or properly maintaining that IC. So on this slide, there is a screenshot from the state of Missouri. And this shows a dry cleaner that has an institutional control closed dry cleaner in the city of St. Louis. And it's actually relatively close to my neighborhood. And that, I guess, makes me a version of a stakeholder. And I have the option to go out and pull information on that and drill down and find out information in my nearby area. So providing multiple and redundant communication methods for IC stakeholders will help to ensure success over the long term. And that's what we're talking about, the long term. Remember, ignorance is not bliss when it comes to institutional controls. So based on the results of our ITRC survey, IC outreach is definitely a work in progress and needs some improvement. And as we've discussed, uninformed stakeholders are a recipe for IC failure. Now, our survey showed that the vast majority of outreach is focused on current property owners only. That's nearly 90%. Now, where it starts to fall off quickly is less than half of new owners are included in outreach. In that example I just gave from Nebraska, we reached out to the new owners, but according to our survey, less than half, 43%, are reaching out to new landowners. And so right off the bat, you're limiting your long-term stewardship. And then only 20% of tenants or adjacent landowners are included in outreach. And as we've discussed, there's a lot more potential stakeholders than just these listed here, and those percentages drop off to single digits very quickly. So use robust IC outreach to inform and educate stakeholders. This means identify and provide outreach to all potential stakeholders. Be aware of and anticipate stakeholder information needs. Tailor your information to those stakeholders and keep it understandable. I'm as guilty as anyone using acronyms and technical language, but if you get too far into that, people aren't going to understand what they can and can't do. So use both push and pull communication methods. And remember, IC and communication are not static. Revisit your outreach over time and update it as necessary. There's always new tools for communication, web-based and whatnot. Just be aware of that, and you can update that as things go along. So also, the IC stewardship tool I mentioned earlier, I'll just give it another plug here. It'll be described later in this presentation. We can help create and manage successful outreach to IC stakeholders. So we've discussed the need for available, easily understood, and up-to-date records as part of stakeholder communication and outreach. And Lynn Bailey of the Hawaii Department of Health will next discuss IC data management and registries.
Thank you, Doug. Let's start with a basic definition of a registry. A registry is a centralized repository of information about institutional controls throughout an agency or another type of organization. IC registries can be maintained by state and federal agencies, local government entities like county health departments, for example, corporate environmental management managers with multiple properties, or other agencies or organizations. This section is going to focus most on IC registries which are maintained by state agencies. And we'll start with a poll. Juliana, could you open the poll for me, please? Please answer, choose one answer that best describes your answer. Have any of you experienced or witnessed a problem or violation of an IC due to lack of awareness where a registry could have made a difference? Well, we already got a lot of answers coming in, and looks like the yeses have it. Oh, no's are catching up. Okay, thank you all for participating. Let's go ahead and close the poll for now. Thanks, Juliana. So I think as we go through this section of the presentation, you, like I will, if you've answered no, may be surprised how a registry can help. It can really assist with that push and pull of information that Doug was talking about in the previous section. So we actually did a survey, as the other speakers have discussed, in August 2015, where we reached out to the states and the territories. And this map shows which state agencies have registries and whether the registries are for internal agency use only or are for public use as well. As you can see with the royal blue states, a significant number of states have no registry at all. The majority do have some type of registry, at least with internal agency access. And a lot of them also do have public access. So if you combine the public access and the internal agency use only, it's quite a significant number, which is a good sign, but we can still improve on this. So if you look from that same August 2015 survey, the inadequate monitoring, inadequate communication, and poor description of IC location are large contributors to IC failure. And if you can recall the case study that Kevin Schrems discussed in slide 11, he mentioned similar issues with that close call. So all of these issues can be fixed with a good registry that can allow you to schedule things to prevent inadequate monitoring, improve communication efforts, and allow for location information of the institutional controls. And in fact, in that same survey, when asked how they would improve their state's IC program, several respondents indicated that better tracking systems and registries would be important. So registries can be beneficial to the public and to agencies. So first of all, we'll talk about the internal use of the registry, how these registries can benefit the agencies themselves. There are many different functions these registries can provide, as shown on the slide. Additionally, registries can make it possible for an agency to prepare invoices for land stewardship, describe inspection results, document institutional control breaches, describe response actions for noncompliance, track enforcement referrals, manage the issuance, modification, or termination of institutional controls or permits, or they can even use repositories or use the registries as document repositories. In fact, different divisions can have a shared database to allow easier sharing of information. There are many different uses within the agency. So a registry is basically this current repository of up-to-date information about each institutional control. So here's an example about from that Missouri State Management and Reporting System that you saw a screenshot earlier of on Doug's presentation. This is a typical internal view of what would be in a good registry. As you can see from the tab across the top, there are a lot of different types of information that are captured in this simple interface, including contamination. Another tab shows the types of media like soil, groundwater, or air, remedial objectives, instrument details, which would be information on the type of institutional control instrument, like a deed restriction or a covenant. Importantly, the contacts are also represented on this database. You could, at your fingertips, you have information about the owner, agency personnel who are working on it, and other stakeholders who are relevant to the successful implementation of the institutional control. Another tab shows activity monitoring, like records of periodic monitoring or like groundwater monitoring reports or records such as breached engineer barriers and inspections. And the final tab includes a PDF repository of reports that are associated with this particular project. So as we mentioned, not just the internal agency can benefit from a registry, but so can the public. Now, the internal registry will probably include information that will not be available on the public interface, such as the public interface may not include information about all the documents or correspondence associated with enforcement, for example. However, as Doug mentioned, in order to maintain IC success, it is critical to have current accessible information available to the stakeholders. Some relevant stakeholders are shown on this slide, and the registry may help them in such ways as, for instance, the owners may be able to research the registry when developing long-term stewardship plans. Buyers of the property or people performing due diligence can research the registry information when doing phase one all appropriate inquiries during property transfers. Developers may need to be aware of engineering controls such as a cap or a barrier, and they'll need to develop their plans and in a way that will work around those limitations. Another key stakeholder who needs access to public information is that construction and utility worker community. They definitely need to know where there's contaminated soil or groundwater in order to protect their workers by providing the proper training, hazard communication, and personal protective equipment. However, the public also is protected when the utility and construction workers are aware of these ICs. Because if these companies are prepared when they arrive on a site that has contamination and they know about the contamination, they know about the restriction, that can prevent a larger release or improper use of media, such as taking soil from a contaminated site and potentially reusing it someplace like a school where you would not want contaminated soil to end up. There is a good tie-in to OneCall and an 811 database that some states use, and Michael will be discussing that in a future presentation. As Doug mentioned, adjacent landowners may also want to look at registries for information about nearby properties that have ICs that could impact their property or their property value. Now, here is the public view of that same Missouri database. And as you can see, on slide 32, we saw the internal registry. And this is what the public would see from that same database. And it allows the public to locate different sites geographically. they don't need an EPA ID, or they don't need to go through lists of facility site names and tables to find the site that they're interested in. They don't have to do a search of addresses. They can just click on a pin to view more information on the site. And if you note, there are different categories of sites. The yellow pins, for instance, are sites with activity and land use limitations that would require long-term stewardship. So when developing a registry, the first thing you'll need to do is complete an inventory of sites with institutional controls. You'll be working with a bunch of project files, spreadsheets, lists, and old dusty papers. It'll be a tremendous effort to create the registry and verify all the information. You'll need to decide which attributes will be included and how those attributes, how that information will be standardized. For instance, if you're working with geographic information, there are multiple types of datums and projections that people may use to enter coordinates. You can display information as polygons, like boundaries of an IC area, or point features, like wells. You'll also need to decide which information will be available to the public and which will only be accessible internally. And once all of the information is included in the database, you aren't done. You can't just walk away at that point and say, whew, that was a big job, I'm done. The registry will require maintenance. There needs to be frequent verification of accuracy. So maintaining and updating a registry are key. Errors and omissions will need to be fixed. Updates to parcel identifiers, as Doug mentioned at his site, where the parcels were split after the IC was in place. Those updates will need to be made in order to ensure the ICs are protected. Browsers like Chrome or Firefox that people use to view the database or the registry may change, and that may impact the functionality, as well as sometimes internal programs that make up the background of the registry, like access or geographic information systems programs, may change as well, and that could affect the functionality. Additionally, there are probably periodic daily or weekly backups, archives, and versioning control features that will need to be verified regularly. So all of this requires staff time and a delegated, robust, and ongoing budget to keep up with all of these issues. So ensure when you're planning for your registry, you incorporate maintenance as well, because it is critical to keeping it up and functioning well. And speaking of functioning well, here is another drilled down site from that Missouri database. You can view the pop-up basic information about the site and then click on the site for the detail. You saw the pin. You click on the pin and it drills down. And if there's also a link within this pop-up that you can follow for more details. And there's a bounding box that marks the extent of the institutional controls. And right there at a glance, the public has most of the information they need, and they know to go where the link is to find more information if they want it. And with that, I'll hand it off to Juliana for questions and answers.
Thanks, Lynn. Everyone is welcome to send in questions using that Q&A box in the lower right. If you're in the phone line, now's your chance to unmute #6 and jump in with questions. Before we get to those questions, I do want to remind you, at the end of today's class, we are looking for everyone to fill out the feedback form. We really do use the information that you provide and appreciate you taking just a few minutes at the end to give us your feedback. It's also your opportunity to create a certificate. So if you want a certificate for attending, be sure to fill out the feedback form and check the box at the bottom to certify you attended. Once you submit, the system's going to generate that certificate for you. And right now, that's the only way to get the certificate. So if you forget to check the box, just go back, check the box, submit again. A question that came in, I know Doug's answered online, but others may be interested. What is the difference between a deed restriction and a land use covenant? Are they the same thing?
This is Mike Sawinski. I'll take that for starters. Yes and no. The term deed restriction is really an umbrella term that is used to describe all types of institutional controls that are recorded on in the land records in one way or the other. So a land use covenant is a type of covenant recorded in the land records and therefore is a type of deed restriction. And so, and there's some other types of deed restrictions that, you know, different states have different names for them, but basically it's just an umbrella term.
At what government level, state, country, city, do you recommend a database be developed for?
I would say any database would be helpful. You'd want it to be specific and available to people so they know to find it. You know, I mean, the Missouri one we've been showing is statewide, which is probably pretty helpful. But I'm sure there's instances where you can look on a more municipal type basis as well. But, you know, I kind of think the state model is a pretty good one. But, you know, you take what you can get and work from there. You know, they're not every state has one, so I guess you just have to search and find what's best, and hopefully as things progress, they'll improve the registries over time.
Is the complete survey and responses available to the public?
This is Lynn. Yes, I believe we incorporated the survey into an appendix of the team document. So if you go to the ITRC website or the resources, you can access the ITRC document and just find the survey questions you're interested in the appendix.
Thank you. I'm going to give it just another moment for a few more questions to come in, see if they do come in. A reminder for our audience again, before you wrap up today, we really do need your feedback, so we appreciate you taking just a few minutes before you leave the website to give us your feedback. And at the end of the training, we'll have a link to the feedback form, or if you want to, you know, start the feedback now, in the middle right, the related links, the fourth one down, you may need to scroll down to see it, is a link to our feedback. And then you need to look down a bit, select browse to get that to open in a new window for you. So all of our related links today will open, but you do need to select the link and then look down a bit, select browse to. So we have a question that came in for someone who works at a nuclear waste site. How do you maintain a registry for more than a couple hundred years when we see numerous changes in electronic media in just a few years?
Well, I think that goes back to this Doug Burge in my section. You know, I talk about revisiting communication outreach, and I think, you know, even in the shorter term, I think it's something you want to keep in the back of your mind. And obviously, things change and things seem to change faster all the time, but there's more tools available. So as those tools become available to make the institutional control people aware of it and know the restrictions, I think you got to take advantage of that. But that's just something as things move on down, you know, use best practices at the time of.
Thanks. Earlier in the presentation, you said that we're not going to focus on the planning and implementation of ICs, that there's other guidances that address that. Can you provide information on those other guidance for planning and implementing ICs?
This is Mike Sawinski, and I believe the guidance document cites it to this, but I think the best starting point is the EPA guidance titled Planning, Implementation, Monitoring, and Enforcement of Institutional Controls, and it's a pretty fulsome document that covers implementation issues, among other things.
Yeah, this is Doug Burge. If they can't find it readily, they can shoot me an email privately, and I can send them some of the information that we relied on or that I mentioned as far as ITRC, EPA, and others.
Thank you. And for our participants, back on that CLUIN training page, so the related links, middle right, second one down, select that, select browse to. You can see contact information. Once you scroll down a bit, you can see contact information about each of our trainers if you need to contact them to follow up with some of your questions. We'll continue on with the second half of the training. We should have time at the end of today's presentation to answer more questions. So throughout the second half, you are welcome to send in questions using that Q&A pod in the bottom right. For now, we'll continue on with the next section, and I'm going to turn it over to Michael Sawinski at Teradex.
Thank you. And before I start, I'll just answer that question again, because I just remembered that as to implementation of institutional controls, there's an ASTM guidance titled ASTM 2091 that actually does a really good job of describing the whole process of planning for and implementing institutional controls. So keep that in mind as well. Okay. My section is not on implementation, but rather is the next step in the process titled monitoring and performance evaluation. So building and related to the stakeholder outreach and the registry and so forth that have been discussed, monitoring and performance evaluation really gets to the point, and Doug put it best earlier where he said when someone installs a well, you have to, when an institutional control says don't install a well, you don't install a well, and he said you need to make sure others don't install a well too. And you know, how do states do that? How do private actors do that, whether it's a well or whether it's an excavation or whatever? And that's really where the monitoring and performance evaluation process kicks in. In this presentation, in my section here, you'll learn hopefully about the common methods and the best practices for IC monitoring. And you already know, because you answered in the prior polls, that institutional control monitoring matters, and it's actually one of the most important pieces of feedback that both in the survey but in all the surveys that we've ever given, IC monitoring always comes up on at top of the list for what's important as far as an IC program goes. And let me just, for the sake of getting started, IC monitoring refers to the collection of data information. I'll explain in a second more about that. And then performance evaluation goes, well, now that I have data information, what does that mean? How do I make decisions based on that? And when I've given this presentation in the past, people understandably have said, well, what are you talking about, IC monitoring? Do you mean, you know, environmental monitoring, taking samples of soil? No, this is not conventional environmental monitoring. IC monitoring is different. And to get us all on the same page, remember that regardless of the institutional control, whether it's a deed restriction that we talked about earlier, or whether it's a no further action letter that has conditions on it, or whether it's a consent decree, or whatever the form that the institutional control takes, they ordinarily require similar types of conditions or prohibitions, like don't use the groundwater, don't excavate, or maybe there's limitations on excavation, don't use for residential use, no use for daycares, et cetera, no new structures without vapor intrusion protections, et cetera. So these are all the things that can't be done, and the process of monitoring for IICs looks at what is actually happening at the property at which an IIC exists to learn whether there's activities that might violate or be in conflict with all these different requirements. So IIC monitoring is about different ways to look at the activities at the property, whether it's driving by, like Kevin talked about earlier in their pilot, or other types of methods that I'll talk about now. So the six major approaches that states are moving forward with are inspections and record reviews, whether it's by the state themselves or whether it's by the obligated party, such as the landowner, excavation monitoring via one call, other types of land activity monitoring, local government coordination with the state or federal government, and then in one state, an IC permit program. So how do all these work? What are the states doing? What are the advantages and disadvantages? That's what I'm going to get into one by one now. But for starters, with that backdrop, maybe we can just get a sense from you all of the following, which of the following do you, in your experience, utilize for monitoring IICs? I'll take a few minutes to let those answers come in. And I can see already, and I'll just start to talk, but please continue to answer. The most common, and perhaps not surprisingly, the on-site inspections and record reviews are the most common approaches because they're the most conventional approaches, and that's how we do monitoring in the environmental space. Approaches such as excavation and other types of land activity monitoring, as I'm watching now as the answers come in, are increasingly common, but still are not rising to the level of the classic inspection approach. As I'll talk about more, these other approaches, excavation, land activity, local government coordination, are in some ways more sophisticated, arguably, and there's a trend, an increasing trend towards their use. I think that's probably enough time to move on to the next area. Thank you for your responses. Okay. So approach number one, fairly straightforward, state agency inspection and record review. So the state agency staff just design a process to look at all the sites with institutional controls. And so it's administered by people at the state agency. There's a schedule set and managed by someone at the agency. Often the agency will create some sort of standard inspection form for use by their project managers or other staff. They do a little bit of homework usually based on what's required, what the institutional control says, and then they go out and visit a site and view and record what they see based on what's required, create some sort of an inspection date and findings that they typically record internally, and typically save inspection reports. That being said, there are one or two states, California in particular, that make these inspection reports public for viewing on the website, which I've always felt is a good practice for transparency. So that's it. You know, there's nuances and details, but it's a fairly straightforward inspection approach. Similarly, states, instead of doing it themselves, they require what we call in our guidance an obligated party to do the inspection. An obligated party, normally, depending on the type of institutional control, but it's normally the current landowner who's burdened with this responsibility. And normally, in most states, the requirement for the obligated party to do the inspection is set forth in the environmental covenant, which is a popular type of deed restriction or land use control, et cetera, recorded in the chain of title. Some states create standard forms that they send to the property owners, obligated parties, for them to use. Not all states. Some states send annual reminder letters to help, to help assure that they're getting these certifications back from the obligated party. The agency tracks the receipt of the certifications, and when they don't get their annual report from the landowner, that's what can trigger different types of more increased inspection or monitoring. And incidentally, what happens is often I hear that these annual reports help the agency learn about ownership changes, and it cuts both ways. Sometimes ownership changes, they don't know about it, and then they have a hard time, sending the reminder letter in the first place. But ultimately, through this process, they can normally sort out who the ownership is, even though sometimes it's a little bit of a burden. So the third method starts to move away from what I was earlier calling the conventional inspection approaches to an increasingly popular approach where states are linking in or tapping into the 811 or one call system of the state and to receive information about excavations and compare that to requirements of institutional control. So this, in summary, this process requires the connection between the 811 and the agency so that the 811 provides the agency with notices of excavation. That then the states are able to email or text advisories to the excavator to essentially say your planned excavation is near or above or involves contaminated soil and you should take certain precautions or contact us, et cetera. And ordinarily, these approaches rely on a third-party intermediary to help manage the ticket flow and other business processes here. And let me, I often get a lot of questions, so I'm just going to take a minute to explain in more detail how this works. Just backing up all the way, one call centers exist in every state anyway, regardless of any environmental issue or institutional control issue. These centers exist for the purposes of underground facility owners, gas, water, and electric facilities joining into the 811 center so that excavators can in turn call the 811 center and learn about the 811 center then notifies these gas, water, electric utility owners who then go to the site and mark, as we've all seen this, mark out on the street the locations of these lines so the excavators do not dig into the and bust out a water line or electric line, et cetera. It's a process that's been around for a long time. In the environmental world, we now are able to leverage this process, and instead of an underground utility, we're able to register, we meaning states and private parties are doing this as well, register areas of interest into the One Call Center so that the same process, the excavator, when they call the 811 center, they're notified about this area. And rather than the agency or the private party marking the line, the process ordinarily relies on some sort of electronic transmission of information about what's going on at the site compared to what the excavator plans to do. This is an example of Delaware. The state of Delaware is using this process as well as more than a handful of other states, Idaho, California. I know I'm forgetting some, West Virginia. I personally work with a lot of these states, but I'll remember more in a minute. But this fact page goes out routinely from Delaware every time that an excavation is happening near any of their remediation sites, and it essentially warns, it shows the excavator where they are compared to the site. And it explains some issues about the site and provides links for more information and contact information to the agency. So in this way, the agency is a powerful tool for them to help avoid any issues that of excavations into contaminated soil. So that is the One Call process, like I said, increasingly being used more and more. Approach number four, incidentally, I've numbered these approaches just for the sake of writing the report, so they don't necessarily have any rhyme or reason. Approach number four of land use and activity monitoring is a little bit like excavation monitoring in the sense that it's relying on an electronic process, connection to electronic feed of land activity information, where agencies are able to send email alerts to people, stakeholders involved with the sites. And again, number three and number four here are the ones where third parties are normally relied on. Here, when the boundaries of the sites are known, the process can tap into all sorts of electronic activity, electronic sources about building permits, land development permits, water well permits, water well construction reports, ownership changes, sensitive uses, schools, and dredging and fill of wetlands, stormwater permits. I mean, there's lots of information related to what might be going on in a site that could be relevant to as to whether there's any conflicts or monitoring issues with respect to the institutional control requirements. So this process, similar to the excavation one, electronic feed of information, and then there's electronic information, electronic, alerting and managed process where states can, have a sort of a dashboard of all of the activities that are happening at their sites, and then they in turn can send advisories or those one-page facts, like I showed you from Delaware, to different stakeholders so that they can be aware that things have recently or about to happen at institutional control site that they need to be aware of. Number three and number four are, popular, well, increasingly popular methods, very powerful. Number five, fifth approach, IC monitoring coordination with local governments can be very powerful. Here I'm explaining this in sort of three levels because there's different, there's coordination and then there's coordination. But many states do what I've just dubbed minimum coordination, where the state agency essentially informs local government about the ICs, and then it's a one-way street, and the local government does or does not take action based on their own preferences, given the information from the state. There are other more robust coordinative approaches, one of which I call the eyes and ears approach, where in addition to the state agency informing the local government, then the local government then agrees to inform back to the state agency as to all the permits that might be impacting that the IC, and I'll show an example of that in a second. But that way, the state agency is learning from the local government about different activities that their permitting process is bringing to light that may be happening at or near an institution control site. Finally, there's a local government lead coordinated approach where this really happens at big mega sites, particularly big Superfund sites, where the whole local government might be impacted by a Superfund site, and that in turn triggers the local government to even enact an ordinance or otherwise develop some sort of fulsome project that is devoted towards institutional control management. So this does happen, but it really tends to be spurred on when the local government is heavily impacted. Like some local governments are impacted by mining site where there's lead deposition throughout the whole jurisdiction, and so they need to develop a whole program to make sure that lead contamination in the soil doesn't impact their citizens. Here's just a quick example of the eyes and ears approach that I mentioned earlier, which is happening in Colorado, where the state agency sends through GIS polygons, essentially sends shapefile or electronic information to the city of Denver, and then the Denver takes that and overlays it into their GIS system so that the people at the local level see their normal internal permitting system with these red dots showing states of interest to the state where there's an institutional control. And then based on this information, every week they develop a spreadsheet that shows all the different permits that have been applied for and at or near those red dots, if you will, that the state has given to them. And then the state's then informed about, there's a commercial construction permit at a particular area. And then knowing what it knows about the institutional control, the state can, if it needs to, take action in light of the information that the local government has provided up to it. So the local government is just providing information. It's not enforcing institutional controls, but it's providing the state agency some information that the state agency can in turn use to perhaps take a monitoring and enforcement action if needed. And this is just a quick example. It's not quick. I just don't have a lot of time to go into all the details. We're what I call the local government lead example. And so you can Google this up or read our guidance document for more details. But here in Jasper County, Missouri, the health department needed to create a whole environmental contamination ordinance, which was directed. If you read the ordinance, you'll see it directed as an institutional control to control to protect people from lead contamination, and it sets forth all kinds of conditions about digging into new soil before constructing homes, etc., and testing the soil and all sorts of things so that lead contaminated soil isn't moved around and shipped off as clean fill, etc. So there's one more approach, which is IC permit approach, which is currently in place only in New Jersey. So I wouldn't call it necessarily a trend, but it's worthy of note because of its novelty, really. And one way to think of it is, the way I think of it is an approach where the agency is requiring the obligated party to do annual inspections or certification, but rather than recording those requirements in the deed, it's actually a state-run program with a permit that gets re-upped, I believe, every 2 years with an associated fee. It's called a remedial action permit, and the requirements differ a little bit with respect to whether there's groundwater at issue or whether there's a soil contamination at issue, but the main point being that because it's a permit program that gets re-upped with new fees the way permits do, it provides the state a formalized mechanism to not only collect some fees, but also to make sure that there's always an obligated party who's always inspecting their ICs and submitting certification reports to the agency, and so the agency can make sure that institutional controls are, in fact, being complied with. Sort of stepping back and looking at thinking about all those different six approaches and go, what is really happening in the state? The ITRC guidance document explains in some more detail, but summarizing it up, the state approaches range from, nothing. There's still some states that aren't implementing any monitoring approaches to those that implement one approach, which is when it's a one, it's typically an IC inspection approach, to those that are combining or two or more approaches. And I'll talk about some specifics in detail, but you'll see states that are doing inspections and also at the same time doing excavation and other land activity monitoring to complement their inspection approach. The idea being that that they can save money by doing less inspections by targeting other approaches smartly on the sites that really need it. So here's a few select states just to give you a sense. It's not representative of all 50 states, but these are how some states are designing their monitoring program. So in Pennsylvania, which is a classic approach, and they're requiring their landowners to provide them certifications, and on top of that, the state agencies perform their own inspections, and there's written requirements to make sure all of this happens smoothly, and it can work very well. Colorado does the same thing, but as I showed earlier, then they also add on top of that a coordinated approach with local governments as another layer of monitoring. Idaho and California sort of do more of a fulsome approach where they are they are requiring landowners to send certifications on an annual basis typically. They select sites based on a prioritized scheme for the state themselves to inspect, and then they rely on the excavation monitoring and the land use and activity monitoring that I discussed earlier to complement those approaches where they get daily or weekly information about land activities happening at their properties. And through these approaches, these are examples of real fulsome IC monitoring approaches at some states. So just sort of looking at the pros and cons, the inspections and the owner certifications, they're weak in the sense that they're periodic. Whether they're 1 year or sometimes less frequently has its inherent weaknesses because things can happen in the intervening time. But at the same time, when they do happen, they can be comprehensive because when you can go out and visit the site and do your homework, and you can really get a good sense of what's happening there. They do require staff and resources. Even in the case where the owners are doing the certifying, the agency still has to administer the process, which can be burdensome. The excavation and land activity, they're powerful in that they're often daily, so there's a steady stream of information flowing. Their weaknesses have to do with the fact that they're more complicated, and they typically require a third-party contractor to support the workflow needed and through web-based pages and dashboards and things like that where the information is coming in and the tools are provided so that the email and text can be sent out to the different stakeholders. But they can be comprehensive and tailored. Coordinated, the local government approach can be very powerful too, and depending on which approach is taken, I guess you call it a weakness is that there's a non-conventionality about the coordination required here. And local governments aren't typically in the business of dealing with environmental-related monitoring. So, in the case of Colorado, the agreement that the state and the city of Denver struck took some time. They had to write a memorandum of understanding and negotiate it through and really understand whose responsibility was what, and there were lawyers involved. But once they got through all of that, then the approach was is working nicely. So there's some inertia to overcome there. The IC permit has the same weaknesses as the inspections up here, but it's stronger and it's arguably stronger in the sense that it's more formal and it provides some ability to collect money. What's the best approach? I mean, it depends. What the guidance documents helps lay out in the framework is look at your site, triage them based on how risky is the institutional control issue. I mean, are the things being protected there of low risk, or do you have a site where the institutional control is really protecting against some risky stuff, lead contamination in the soil, for example? And then related to that, if there is a conflict in the IC or a violation, are the consequences low, moderate, or high? So it's just a framework to help design an approach. Because what ends up happening is that, at least in my experience, there's a chunk of sites that tend to be fine finally served through a once-a-year inspection process where there's a chunk of sites that tend to need some more attention through some of the other more sophisticated approaches. So I also promised that, you know, I would talk a little bit about, with all that monitoring data that's collected through any one of those six approaches, then what, you know, what do you do with that, and what does state do with that? Well, first and foremost, and the best case, is that you learn that your ICs are protective and effective, and you have an actual record to show that that's the case. Or often there's, you know, IC compliance issues that pop up, ranging from small administrative ones, like someone was late filing a certification, to other minor ones that can be cured. Maybe there was an excavation that occurred that technically wasn't supposed to, but the contaminated soil was managed appropriately, and there was really no issue. To major ones, which could trigger more compliance and even enforcement action. Sometimes the monitoring lets you know that, you know, hey, the monitoring you're doing isn't good enough, or maybe it's too good, and so it allows you some information to change and hopefully reduce the cost of IC monitoring in the first place. You know, to know whether your IC can be terminated, that information pops up during monitoring. And then finally, and Kevin Schrems will be talking about this in a bit, that, you know, the final, hopefully never gets to this point, but there are some cases where institutional control issues rise to the level of an actual enforcement action needing to be taken. One of the best practices that the guidance document, the ITRC guidance document mentioned was, you know, it maybe seems obvious, but to focus some attention usually in the way of policy or guidance that addresses how the state is going to handle IC monitoring. I mean, if you're listening to this presentation, it maybe sounds simple, but most state programs are, you know, understandably focused on cleaning up sites. But, you know, as we all are now seeing, we're slowly and surely sliding from cleanup into stewardship. So, the type of attention that was needed to cleanup is now being needed more and more just towards the stewardship. And part of the stewardship means the IC monitoring. So some states have taken that leap and are, you know, describing and prioritizing how they're going to do IC monitoring, which really helps them focus how to do stuff. Which brings up, well, how are we going to, everyone always says, well, how are you going to pay for this? And so this, in our guidance document and right here, there's really two pieces of information we can provide to help on that, because it's always a hard question. You know, money's tough to come by. Point one is that in the spirit of non-reinventing the wheel, our guidance document refers to an SWAMO effort. There's a link here, and it's also linked in the guidance document that helps states understand. You know, when you have an IC program, there's lots of elements to it, and they all have cost elements, from planning to community engagement to the information management of the registry to the monitoring that I was just talking about, and even enforcement. And their efforts do a good job of, and even provide some spreadsheet tools to really help cost estimate the cost to an agency for the ICs. And I just give you a rule of thumb. I don't even know how much it's, I think that the rule of thumb is that over a 30-year span, if you look at a normal site, it probably costs an agency who's doing a, you know, solid program $750 to $1,000 per site per year. Just a rule of thumb, based on what I've seen, it's for those who are wondering. And how do you get this money? Well, there's different approaches. States, seven or eight approaches, and the guidance document lays this out in more detail, and charge a fee or collect fees in one of two ways. One way is to collect an upfront fee. And in this case, this is just a little snippet of a Missouri regulation that allows for the collection of an upfront institutional control fee. And in their case, they can get up to $15,000 at the time of allowing their IC, which is supposed to fund, you know, 30 years plus of the agency's efforts to monitor it. they've told me, and they would probably tell you, that they wish they could have more than that, but that's where they're locked into with the regulation, because when it was drafted, they didn't, whoever was drafting it didn't have all the information probably as to what an IC program really costs. I would think it should be at least $30,000. Just that's my personal opinion for what it's worth. And the other way that states collect IC fees, like New Jersey, but this is also in a California example, is on an ongoing basis. So rather than just a one-time fee, they have developed systems where once a year or once a quarter, they can send a bill. New Jersey does it through their permit program, like I described earlier, and California does it through language in the deed restriction. So in the deed restriction itself, the owner agrees to pay the department's cost in administering the covenant. It's a little bit like people who agree to sign up for voluntary cleanup programs and pay the cost to the state agency for their efforts. In this case, the agency does what they do to administer the IC, and they send a bill to the landowner, and that requirement runs with the land through the land use, through the deed restriction. And that concludes my section on monitoring and performance evaluation, which naturally segues, like I said, to Kevin, who is going to pick up on enforcement.
Thanks, Mike. I'm sure many of you on the phone or at your computer are geologists and engineers or other technical staff that focus on making sure all the appropriate exposure pathways are adequately defined and addressed by the chosen institutional control. Now, myself, as a staff member who works as a liaison with the Department of Attorney General in Michigan and the technical project managers at the district or local offices, I may be contacted when the enforceability or enforcement of an institutional control comes into question. For this portion of the presentation, I'm going to highlight many of the enforcement tools contained in the ITRC IC guidance document that should be considered when planning, implementing, and approving the type of institutional control that is best suited for the selected remedy. Even the regulated community will benefit from this part of the guidance, because having an understanding of the enforcement process for your state will provide an understanding of the overall enforcement process, how it works in your state, so, you know, thinking about transparency, and being able to work through the enforcement issues. You know, if somebody comes to you with an enforcement question or enforcement notice, you know, you'll have the tools to help work through and hopefully bring the violation or potential violation back to back into compliance. ITRC's survey illustrates weaknesses in state monitoring and compliance efforts. If adequate monitoring and management requirements are not established as part of your state IC program, then there's going to be little to enforce. Indeed, ITRC's survey results indicated that approximately two-thirds of state agencies never have taken an enforcement action against a responsible party regarding an institutional control. This is a significant statistic to keep in mind, because we know failures and violations of ICs do happen. Overall, the data amplifies the necessary relationship between adequate IC management tools and the foundation they provide to an overall meaningful IC enforcement program. So let's take a little moment to stretch our fingers and try an enforcement poll question. So Juliana has opened it for us. The question is, does your state you represent or where you have implemented an IC have an enforcement process in hand if an IC violation is identified, regardless if you have taken enforcement action in the past? Okay, we can close the poll. It looks like the vote getter is, we're not sure if we have an enforcement process in hand if an IC is violated, which is important to know, as I had mentioned before, because, you know, failures can and likely will happen. So we need to know what are the consequences of a failure. Is it, you know, the informal approach or formal approach, which I'm going to get into here in my section. I've previously touched upon the concepts and challenges when considering enforceability during the planning and implementation phases of institutional controls. And Michael Sawinski also covered the importance of monitoring as part of a long-term management program. In addition to these two challenges, which ITRC offers possible solutions in its guidance, identifying the proper parties to enforce the provisions of an institutional control can be complex and complicated. And even though ICs are most commonly tied to laws independently administered by the state and local jurisdictions, many states may not have explicit authorities written into their respective statutes. Add into that the uniqueness of native land and federal facilities. Another challenge is that there is currently no model framework to guide a compliance and enforcement strategy that is specific to institutional controls. And finally, the Uniform Environmental Covenants Act, which is a model statute that can be adopted into law, provides legal framework to create, modify, enforce, and terminate an institutional control more or less specific to environmental covenants. But the model language only provides for those conventional common law reliefs, such as trespass or nuisance, once a violation occurs, and does not provide a compliance assistance framework that many state regulators seek to use first. ITRC's guidance document recognizes the challenges to enforcement of institutional controls and discusses the various legal authorities beyond the traditional statutory dependence that regulators and other parties responsible for assuring compliance may use. For example, in my state, the remediation statutes require that restrictive covenants contain a provision granting the department the ability to enforce the restrictive covenant by legal action in a court of competent jurisdiction. So each restrictive covenant has that written into it, and it can be pointed out when an issue comes up. Instruments such as consent decrees document an administrative or judicial court's approval of a settlement of an enforcement case that's filed in the court. Now, typically, consent decrees specify the actions taken or not to be taken by the settling parties. Consent decrees may have penalties attached for noncompliance. Because there is no common model legal framework for ICs, the ITRC guidance document suggests that the construction of a basic IC enforcement model can be premised on the traditional environmental enforcement model that's used for air, water, and waste. When IC compliance failure occurs, the enforcement can be strategically applied toward the party's return to compliance, also deter any future violations, and assure protection of receptors from the threat of release or exposure. The ITRC guidance document suggests that the voluntary compliance method emphasize enforcement avoidance, as well as intervention to educate a party on how to comply with IC requirements. In contrast, requiring involuntary compliance from a party through formal enforcement is generally considered the final administrative measure to resolve IC violations. Failing to respond to informal enforcement measures, violations with significant environmental impact, or parties with a history of noncompliance may generally be at least considered for that formal enforcement process. The ITRC's IC guidance document emphasizes that effective enforcement of an institutional control depends on thoughtful IC planning. Enforcement action may be considered when IC requirements have not been observed, have not been implemented or failed to meet the requirements, have not been adequately maintained or monitored if so required, fail to have required certification, or fail to meet the reporting requirements. So again, these all tie back to when an IC fails, and they can fail for many reasons. Once a violation is identified through monitoring, inspection, reporting, or a performance evaluation, the entity who can enforce can then choose either the informal or formal phase previously described. The ITRC guidance document describes the potentially available tools for your agency when seeking to choose the informal or voluntary compliance assistance approach. Voluntary compliance may take many forms and will vary from state to state. Examples include an informal correction letter, a request for corrective action, a deficiency letter, or an inspection report that identifies one or more issues concerning IC requirements. Materials that support an informal enforcement action can be provided to further support the action and to assist the obligated party in fully understanding the IC violation. These materials can include the inspection report, photographs, maps, and copies of relevant regulations or laws. Now, in the event that the party fails to respond to the voluntary compliance measure or fails in any requirement for corrective action within the specified schedule, violations, especially with significant environmental impact or impact to public health, or maybe an obligated party's history of noncompliance, may at least be considered for something more formal like a notice of violation without that benefit of voluntary compliance measures. Formal administrative enforcement measures may include administrative orders, civil or judicial action, and sometimes in the most serious cases, criminal action. So now that I've set the framework for various enforcement strategies, I understand that the process may be a little challenging to put it all together. So ITRC's guidance document does include real-world case study examples. One such example takes place or took place in Concord, Massachusetts. So between the 1919 and the late 1980s, a building occupied the property, which its use was light manufacturing. Between 1989 and 1990, property assessment identified oil-stained soils with PCE and PCE-contaminated groundwater. Unfortunately, remedial actions did not satisfy an unrestricted use. So in 1995, a notice of activity and use limitation, which is ASTM's version of a restrictive covenant, was recorded with the appropriate district register of deeds. The Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection, in their statute, may audit any property for which an activity or use limitation was recorded. So in May of 2012, the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection observed soil disturbance and stockpiled soil at the property. In October of 2012, soil samples collected and analyzed detected concentrations of PCE and extractable petroleum hydrocarbons. So, you know, the oil-stained soils back from the early 90s were still there, and somebody had excavated them and moved them to another location on the property. The earth-moving activities by the tenant of the property were observed without a required health and safety plan or a soil management plan, and both of those were actually violations of the activity and use limitation. Massachusetts law provides for administrative penalties up to $25,000 per day for failure to comply with the terms of an activity and use limitation. Now, in this case, the state assessed a penalty of $5,692 and negotiated an agreement with the property owner to record an amended activity and use limitation to address the violations described above and pay $4,000 in penalties, while the rest were held in abeyance. So Massachusetts authorizes an administrative enforcement framework that begins with the issuance of a compliance assistance letter to the property owner who have a notice of activity and use limitation filed on the property deed. Failures, which are identified through an audit program to comply with an activity and use limitation, is a failure to comply with the Massachusetts statute. An enforcement action may be initiated, as happened in this case. In summary, planning for an IC enforcement action should take place at the time the site-specific IC requirements are developed to carefully evaluate enforceability interested parties, jurisdictional requirements, and what the method for enforcement will be. Enforcement planning should occur as early as the development of a long-term stewardship plan, which Lynn Bailey from the State of Hawaii's Department of Health will now introduce.
Thank you, Kevin. So before we get started talking about a long-term stewardship plan, let's talk about the difference between a long-term stewardship plan and an institutional controller. Those things can sometimes get confused. An institutional control, as is documented in our team's ITRC document glossary, is a legal or administrative restriction on the use of or access to a site or facility to eliminate or minimize potential exposure to chemicals of concern. Now, a long-term stewardship is what is required to ensure the institutional control remains protective of human health and the environment throughout the full IC life cycle. So that is the difference in a nutshell. So everybody thinks, okay, well, the IC is in place. Why do we need a long-term stewardship plan? On top of what we've already done, it's been a long process just to get to the IC point, right? Well, these photos are at a location in Hawaii that needed emergency utility repairs. And this is an area with known contamination, and contamination that's obvious when it's encountered. The first utility company showed up and began dewatering to do their utility repairs. You can see the inlet hoses on the top picture going into the excavation. You can also see that there is free products floating in the water within that excavation. Now, what you don't see is the outlets for those dewatering hoses and the dewatering pumps. They went through pumps. They did not come from a vac truck. They were not, the outlet did not go into a frac tank. Instead, this utility was dewatering into the median of the roadway. Of course, the median did not contain the water, and it ran out into the street. And in Hawaii, at least in this area, the storm drains lead to the ocean. And as you can see in that bottom right-hand photo, it resulted in the product and the contamination definitely was reaching the storm drains. So this actually came to the attention, this release came to the attention of our state on-scene coordinators when somebody called in to report a sheen in the local harbor. Now, at the time of the release, there was no environmental hazard management plan not in place. In Hawaii, an environmental hazard management plan is what we call our long-term stewardship plan. And that type of long-term stewardship plan shows where the contamination is, what it is, and how to manage it. Had there been a long-term stewardship plan in place, and had all stakeholders had access to it, we could have prevented that larger issue, the release to the ocean, the fines from the state and federal governments, and negative public attention. Now, there is an environmental hazard management plan in place for this area now, and we do hope to prevent such issues in the future. So in spite of the importance of a long-term stewardship plan, the ITRC survey found that only 52% of responding states require some sort of long-term stewardship plan. So our team developed a template that will help you create your own plan. The long-term stewardship plan is written after the IC is in place in most situations. It functions much like an operation and management plan or an EPA implementation and assurance plan. So what are the objectives? A good long-term stewardship plan will pull together the requirements of the institutional control, including any engineering control management. It's also a comprehensive guide for the monitoring aspects of the ICs. As Kevin mentioned, that monitoring and inspection process is often how you find there's been a breach in the IC and enforcement may be needed. A good long-term stewardship plan delegates who is responsible for the different steps in monitoring, reporting, and enforcing the IC. the poll at the beginning found that over 60% of you experienced IC failure due to an inadequate communication. Stakeholders must understand the responsibilities in order for the ICs to be effective. The ultimate goal, of course, is to keep the requirements of the institutional control in place long term and to protect human health and the environment, even when the people who initially implemented the IC are no longer part of the project. Now recall that Doug Birch mentioned that these ICs can be in place for decades or even infinity, and we received a comment in the first question break that talked about ICs that will be in place for hundreds of years. So we want to have information that will carry this forward after people who develop these ICs are no longer on the project or around to handle it. Now, how do we know that who writes the long-term stewardship plan and who keeps it to make sure that that information gets out there? The writers and keepers of the long-term stewardship plan will likely vary by state, but in general, the obligated party or the property owner will write it. In some instances, however, a regulatory agency may choose to write the plan. For instance, in Hawaii, we have written EHMPs to manage old sites with historical contamination that are within public rights of way, where the obligated party or the responsible party is no longer identifiable. But yet, we still need to protect the public from the contamination at those sites. And this site shows a small set of the people who should keep the institutional, keep the long-term stewardship plan. But a more complete list is shown on slide 24, and it should include the tenants, the adjacent property owners, and any relevant stakeholders. Now, bear in mind that the long-term stewardship plan should be available to the public upon request, because generally, the more people who are aware of the location of institutional controls and the requirements of the institutional controls and the engineering controls and the associated management of that contamination, the more likely we are to maintain the integrity of the IC and protect human health and the environment. So all of this historical information needed to set the stage for a long-term stewardship plan already exists. We're not asking you to write this from scratch. This information can be found in site closure documents like ROS and the institutional control document itself. The same documents that were discussed earlier as being important for performance evaluation are the documents that we need to create the long-term stewardship plan. Some of them are listed here, but different states and different programs have different types of documents that can be good resources. Additionally, some institutional controls are actually interim institutional controls for sites where remediation is pending or in progress. In that case, you'd pull information from the finalized characterization reports, like remedial investigation reports, or feasibility studies, or even like groundwater monitoring reports, as well as from the interim IC. The long-term stewardship plan will build on the information in these documents and tie it into components such as monitoring, registry, outreach, and enforcement that the team has discussed earlier. So we've created an example site that we'll call Easement that will help us to show you how easy it can be to create an effective long-term stewardship plan. This site was brought to our attention when the tenants of the casting yard northwest of the site were excavating across a pipeline easement to put in wiring for some lighting. You can see the site there. It's a little red box that's surrounded by a big red circle. And the area around it is fairly industrial land. And it has institutional controls in place for observed free product, groundwater contamination, and soil contamination. For our easement long-term stewardship plan, we got the information from the historical documents we already discussed. We pulled some figures from those documents directly into our plan, including standard figures from environmental documents like a site plan with labeled areas of concern and institutional control boundaries, contaminant figures that show delineated contaminants of concern boundaries and the affected media and depths to the contamination, as well as conceptual site models and other information that you want for your map, your so that people can find your site and figure out what's there at a glance. We also pulled site background information directly from the text of those old reports. That background information includes past, current, and anticipated future site use. There's also a summary of previous environmental investigations, like impacted media, the sources of the chemical release, the chemicals of concern, and applicable screening levels and exceedances. So on slide 81, this is just a simplified example of the site plan figure that we pulled into our long-term stewardship plan from the historical documents. You can see the utility excavation in red, where the contamination was initially identified. The five horizontal dotted lines are the pipelines that were most likely the source of the contamination. The green rectangle surrounding the site defines the institutional control boundary, and there are coordinates at the corners of the boundary. Now, of course, you're going to want to know what media are impacted and what contaminants of concern are in the media. So you'll pull those contaminant maps out of your documents as well. And in this case, this is a very simplified contaminant map to make it simple to see on this presentation. However, you're going to want call-out boxes with the concentrations of the chemicals, the depths of the chemicals, and additional information on your maps that will make it relevant to your audience. Now, although the technical aspects of the contamination management at this site seem simple, the responsibility aspect of it is not clear. We talked a little bit about the stakeholders who are involved. There is a pipeline easement with two separate companies responsible for the pipelines and the fuel within them. The casting yard is run by yet another company that's leasing that portion of the land from a large landowner in the area. And the contamination was discovered when that casting yard crew excavated into the easement to put in some lights. And if that scenario isn't complicated enough, at the time of the discovery, the large landowner was finalizing a sale of the property to a new landowner, a new owner. So it's important for the long-term stewardship plan to identify each of these stakeholders and to clarify who's responsible for each step of the monitoring and reporting into the future of this institutional control. Doug discussed how effective communication and outreach between stakeholders can increase the institutional control success. As we write the long-term stewardship plan, the roles and responsibilities of each of the stakeholders must clearly be defined throughout the remaining life cycle of the institutional control. That's through the monitoring and performance evaluations, enforcement, modification, and termination aspects. Now, the key stakeholders and their roles will be identified throughout the text of the IC plan, and this small subset is a subset of the stakeholders that we found relevant to our site, as discussed on the previous slide. But additional known and potential stakeholders from Table 5 of the ITRC document will be included in an appendix of our long-term stewardship plan. Anybody who may be tangentially, like neighboring properties, for instance, you might include on that appendix. So when there are so many parties who are involved with the property that has the ICs, how can we ensure the integrity of the institutional control will continue to protect human health and the environment well into the future? Well, there's an out for that. The institutional control tool will assist the obligated party with writing a long-term stewardship plan that will identify monitoring requirements and clarify the responsibility of all the different stakeholders going forward. It is important that once this long-term stewardship plan is written, after the document is generated, there should be coordination with local regulators to ensure that the long-term stewardship plan meets all the regulatory requirements. So we'll begin by clicking on a team document on the ITRC page to download the tool, and we'll give you the link at the end of the presentation. That will download a zip file, and within the zip file, you'll see a folder called IC_tool and a PDF document called README First. open the README First file, and you'll see a step-by-step instructions for saving and opening the tool. Now, these instructions were created during the early trial runs of the tool, and they're designed based on comments and questions that initial users had. So we really recommend that you use the instructions, and they will save you from frustration later. And if you do have issues later when you're using the tool, if an error pops up, please refer to the instructions, because there could be something simple that you can do that will fix it, and you'll be off and writing your plan again. One error, for instance, that we encountered as we were building the tool resulted when people ran the tool from within the zip file without extracting it. So we'll begin by grabbing onto that IC tool folder that's within the zip file and pulling that down to your desktop to extract the files before you open it. Now you have the IC tool folder on your desktop, and you can open that and look inside, and you'll see two folders and an Excel file. The two folders are called images and templates, and the Excel file is also called IC_tool. Now, this is important. For now, as you're using the tool, please keep all of these files and folders together as they are packaged, and keep them named as they are now, because changing the folder or file names or moving the files or folders will hinder the tool's functionality. But once you're done with it, then you'll have a lot more freedom with moving things around and renaming them. So start by clicking the the IC tool Excel file to open it. Now, for many users, the tool table of contents will pop up immediately after you open the web interface, the IC tool. However, and if so, then your screen will look like the next slide, so you can almost just skip over this slide. However, many users will have their security settings set a little higher, like I do. Those users may need to enable editing, enable content, and or configure the Excel to trust CBA. And this is where that README First file will show you how to do it and will help you out. Once those steps are complete, your screen will look like this. Also, there's an option that you can work on the tool for a while and stop in the middle, save what you're doing, and come back to it later. Once you open it, when you're ready to come back to it, this is also the screen you would see. Clicking click here to get started will send you to the form page where you left off if you are resuming it. And if you wanted to just restart and wipe everything clean and start over again, you click that reset answers button. So the first time you use the tool, whether you click here to get started or whether the tool auto-opens, the first thing you'll see is this tool table of contents. Click Next to go to the next screen. Now you'll see a blank form, and you'll notice that there are four buttons at the bottom. During any time of the process of answering questions and creating your long-term stewardship plan, you can return to the previous page of questions or look at the table of contents by clicking the appropriate buttons, the previous or the table of contents button. The next button is used to advance the tool to the next set of questions in the form. Now note that there might be times when that button is grayed out and it won't advance, and that's on purpose, because if you look at the questions in the form, all of them on this page are marked with a red asterisk. Any question that you encounter that has a red asterisk must be filled in before you can advance to the next page of questions. Now, as you answer the questions, you can fill in the information appropriate to your site and write it as if you were writing a document. Use the information and the decisions that are documented in the IC document and the site closure documents that we discussed before, as well as any information in the interim IC or the ongoing or pending finalized characterization reports that we discussed before for the interim ICs. In some cases, the answers you provide in one question will autofill into more than one location throughout the long-term stewardship plan that you are creating in the background. Be careful not to use sentence fragments or abbreviations unless you want the information to be shortened within the plan. Note what I did there in my question. I filled out, I abbreviated the word department. You will also be able to upload figures that will be inserted into the document. And again, choose those figures from existing site documentation. Whenever you would like to check your work, click on the preview button in the lower right-hand corner on each page of the form. The preview button will allow you to see how your information has been filled into the form and make corrections within the tool if you wish. You can go back and forth between the preview and the Excel tool anytime you want. The answers you gave to questions within the Excel tool will be highlighted blue. Well, on mine it looks blue. It might be a different color on your preview, but it will be highlighted wherever it auto-filled into the long-term stewardship plan that you're creating. And you'll notice that the highlighted text imported into the plan exactly as I wrote it in the form, including the abbreviation. Based on reviewer comments, if you choose not to answer some questions in the tool, the preview will display a highlighted question not answered. So our easement site is technically very simple with just one area that has institutional controls. However, if you have a property with different institutional controls like a tank in one area and pesticide soil in another area, you can use the long-term stewardship tool to create a plan that will work for multiple areas of your site. Just click yes for the second, third, and fourth areas. You'll also have the opportunity to name each area whatever you wish. In my case, I called Area A Easement IC Area. Then you will be led through a series of questions about which types of contamination are controlled with institutional controls and engineering controls for each area. So you can click on the media that apply, which restrictions exist, whether there are signs present, whether the contamination is in the groundwater or the vapors, etc. Several times throughout the presentation, we talked about the importance of activity monitoring and performance evaluation to keep the integrity of the institutional control. We also need to make sure that we know who's going to be doing what on your site and how that information is going to be reported. The long-term stewardship tool asks questions in the monitoring section that tie back to the institutional controls and engineering controls requirements which are specified in the earlier question. This section of the tool helps you choose which types of monitoring are required, who is responsible for the monitoring, how to report the results, and who to report it to. Now, this is what I answer for my site, but of course your answers will be completely different. After completing this section of the tool, a table like this will be included in the long-term stewardship plan for your site. So that previous slide shows what the table will look like within the Word portion of the document, what you'll see on your preview. Now, if you're looking at your tool, this is what you'll see when you want to create a table. The column headings are shown, and there are fill-in boxes that either have pull-down tabs or where you can create, you can type in text directly. So you just move through each box under a table heading to fill in the information. And then after you complete that row, you can click on the plus sign to the right of what you filled in and create a new row and continue on until all the rows you want to complete are filled. After all the required questions have been answered in the entire long-term stewardship tool, this is actually the last page of the tool that you'll see. When you are completed, you can just click on that Create Report button in the bottom right-hand corner of the last page, and a document that's called ITRC IC Final will be created in the folder with the templates. Feel free to save this as another name in another folder. You're now free to edit the document as you would any other Word document. You can edit the text. You can format the heading, add or delete image files, spell check, add or delete paragraphs, whatever you wish to do, rename, add information to the table of contents in the acronyms folders, LIF, etc. Please note that in the final document, unanswered questions will be left as blanks. There will not be highlights, and there will not be the question not answered component. So if there are strange gaps in your document, that might be why. It just might be that you skipped over that question and you'll want to fill it in a different way in your own personal long-term stewardship plan. Users can save the form answers and update later within the tool. So you do that by clicking on the table of contents and you can save it and click on the table of contents, and that will return you to the beginning to start over again. Another option is if you want to reuse that tool for a whole new site, you click on the table of contents and go back to that first screen, and then you can hit the reset answers button and clear it out for your next long-term stewardship plan. As promised, here's a link so you can download your tool and generate your own long-term stewardship plan. And I'm going to turn it back over to Kevin Schrems of Michigan to summarize all the information we discussed today. Kevin?
Thank you, Lynn. So I'd like to circle back around to this diagram that you see on your screen. We've presented this diagram throughout the presentation and in the guidance document. The blue arrow at the top shows the critical elements of the life cycle. Beneath the life cycle, we list the critical elements that should be considered to achieve a successful IC management program. Failure of any of the elements can result in a failure of the IC. These critical elements and components essentially form the structure of the guidance document, and the various sections in the guidance document address each of these elements. The guidance document also provides examples and recommendations for good stewardship practices, including the tool that Lynn just presented for developing a long-term stewardship plan. One of my colleagues who was a trainer on our ITRC group is especially excited about the tool that we developed. A little over a year ago, her company had a project where an IC was being put in place, and the state agency asked for a written formal long-term stewardship plan. At the time, there was really no guidance on how to prepare a plan, so we know that she was excited about the tool that Lynn presented. As we wrap up, I'd like to ask you to think about the ICs where you are a stakeholder. Some of you are a state or local agency project manager, or a responsible party, or a consultant working on behalf of a responsible party. So ask yourself, how are the ICs being managed at your sites in order to ensure long-term success? When we asked the states in our survey, we found that over half of the states responding do not have standard procedures in place for managing ICs across their various programs. So if you do not have a formal IC management program, you're not alone. If you don't have programs in place to manage your ICs, how confident are you in the long-term integrity of ICs at your sites? How do you know that they are continuing to be protective? How do you know that they continue to prevent exposure? I'd like to give another example from another experience that shows the importance of tracking an IC, tracking and maintaining ICs. Another one of our team members, who is a consultant, reviewed a site for an insurance client that had an IC in place that limited the site to commercial or industrial use. The buyer wanted to purchase the site and redevelop it for residential use, not realizing that the site had an IC in place. Needless to say, the insurance company would not place insurance on the redevelopment unless the IC was modified or terminated. Throughout the presentation, I hope that we've drilled home the point that you can use the guidance document to help you develop a long-term stewardship plan. But we also realize that you'll have to go back to your organizations and convince key decision makers to spend the time and money to put these programs in place. We would like to encourage you to hold up this guidance document to support your cause when you are discussing these issues with the key decision makers in your organization. Use the guidance document as a credible consensus-based tool to support your discussions with the key decision makers. And remember, the ultimate goal of ICs is to prevent exposure to contamination that has been left in place. It's that simple. If there's a failure of an IC, the risk of exposure to contamination goes up. Ultimately, we hope that this guidance document will help you avoid situations like the ones in Michigan and Hawaii that were presented earlier. We believe that these situations could have been avoided if the states had used the recommendations and suggestions presented in the guidance document. To conclude our presentation, we'd like to encourage you to review the guidance document and try out the long-term stewardship plan. We've covered a lot of information today, so if you'd like to go back and review the presentation, an archive of this training session will be available through ITRC. Also, please feel free to contact any of the trainers if you have further questions. Our contact information was provided on a slide at the beginning of the PowerPoint presentation, which is available on the website. With that, we'd like to thank you for participating in our training today, and I will turn it back over to our moderator.
Thanks, Kevin. We have almost 10 minutes to answer questions, so I encourage you to send in questions using the Q&A pod in the lower right. We also have a few final poll questions as we're wrapping up today. Also, a reminder, we do look for everyone on the call to complete the feedback form. We really do use your feedback and appreciate you taking just a few minutes. And if you want to follow the link on the third bullet, it's a little small now, but it's there. It takes you to the feedback form, and it's going to open that form in a new window for you. The feedback is also your opportunity to create a certificate for attending today's class. So if that's something that could be useful, be sure to check the box at the bottom to certify you attended. Once you submit, the system's going to generate that certificate for you. And right now, the only way is through the feedback form. So if you forget to check the box, just go back, check the box, submit again. For our phone line participants, you also have the opportunity now to ask questions out loud. And a reminder, it's #6 to mute your phone. Most people do use the Q&A pod to send in questions, so you're welcome to do that as well. The poll questions that we have up on the left upper question, are you ready to use the ITRC's guidance for long-term contaminant management using institutional controls at your sites or within your programs? So we have yes is our leading answer, but if you're saying not yet, I need to learn more. And for both groups, I do encourage you to use the guidance document. So if you go to our links to additional resources, you can see a link to access the guidance document. That's the fastest way to access that now, as well as through the related links. And remember, for those related links, select the name and then look down a bit, select Browse To. And then below that poll question, thinking about your projects that you're working on in the next 6 months, how could you use this ITRC guidance? And as questions or as answers come into that question, you're welcome to scroll through and see those answers as they come in. We have a question from someone who is using the tool to work with the IC tool from ITRC. And when she finished setting up page 2 and clicked Next, the box disappeared. Is the tool compatible with Mac computers?
This is Lynn. No, I'm sorry. We could not make it compatible with Mac computers. We worked to get the versioning issues with the Microsoft computers done first, and then we ran out of budget and time and weren't able to complete the Mac. I'm sorry.
Thank you for the answer. We will give a few more moments for some more questions to come in. For our audience today, we do have some upcoming training classes, and I encourage you to visit the ITRC website. We have a new LNAPL three-part series. If that's something you're interested in, I do encourage you to register right away. I do expect that class registration to fill. So that class is coming up in May. Just a heads up for the people on the phone today that you can register for our new three-part series on LNAPLs. We'll give it a few more moments for questions to come in, see if they're come in through that Q&A pod in the lower right. Everyone is welcome to send in questions using that Q&A pod. A reminder again, we do look for everyone on the call to complete the feedback form. We really do use the information that you provide. We're developing new courses. We also have the opportunity to improve this course. We plan to offer it again later this summer. So, Lynn, did you have something you wanted to add to your comment on the working with the Mac computer?
Not going to get me, let me get away with just typing it in, huh? All right. Sorry, after I hung up or I disconnected and put myself back on hold, I recalled that one of the issues that we had with newer versions of operating systems is that in order to use the tool, we had to incorporate macros into the Excel and the Word versions of the tool. And the new versions of Mac weren't able to allow those macros anymore. I think from if you're using, there were versioning issues with the Excel and the Word itself, and then also that restriction for the Mac. And those were the things that were preventing, as well as the time and budget constraints, from preventing us from developing that Mac tool. I apologize to anyone who uses a Mac. Sorry.
Thanks for adding to that. A comment has come in. We have a Superfund site with a LUC. A water utility installed a plastic sewer line through a portion. Obviously, had there been adequate information sharing between the RP utility and county, this could have been avoided. Would trainers like to comment?
I would like to say that's why we put the document together, I guess. We'd like to try to make ICs more functional over the long term. And, there's the one thing we had, we found failures were relatively easy to find. They occur on occasion. Success stories, maybe a little less so, just because if someone doesn't upset an IC, you just don't hear about it. But there are failures out there, and you try to, if you want it to be effective, you have to maintain it over the long term, or you can just assume eventually something's going to probably happen to it.
I totally agree with Doug on that. A couple of things that this presentation touches on, too, are how the registry can help and that outreach to the stakeholders that Doug discussed. And that one thing that is kind of the bright, shiny object that I wish that we were capable of that we're not quite yet is that connection to the 8111 call system. By getting that registry information public and available to organizations like OneCall or your municipal permitting agencies and sharing information back and forth, a lot of those IC breaches will be stopped before they happen, I think. So I think that you're on the right track, whoever asked that question about, identifying that problem and seeking answers to how to get that information out there. So the 811 and public registry and tie into those permitting agencies are very key to that. I agree.
Thank you. We are almost out of time, so we'll go ahead and wrap up. I'd like to thank our trainers and our participants for joining us today. For participants, if you have a question that we haven't answered or if it comes up later for you, you're welcome to email us at training@itrcweb.org, and we'll pass that along to our trainers from today's class. I'd also encourage everyone to fill out the feedback form if you haven't already. We really do use the feedback.